Hello, this is your friend Russell. Russell Brand, not Russell Crowe, not any of the other Russells. Not Russell Kane or Russell Howard or who? There's some other Russells. Russell Peters. I'm none of them. Russell Brand, I'm him. Oh, Grant, Russell Grant, the astrologer. People don't talk about him so much, but I loved him. He was a great guy, actually. I think I was listening to, like, Andrew Neil on Desert Island Discs, the former Sunday Times, or Times and Sun editor. And he went, you know, well, I'm a Gemini. And I thought, wow, Andrew Neil. You know, people just mention horoscopes. It's mad, isn't it? Anyway, none of that is my point. This is, do you love Elizabeth Gilbert, who wrote Big Magic, Eat, Pray, Love, who's like this sort of force of, I would say, feminine sensuality and creative power. She's really glorious. I'd really recommend you start investigating Elizabeth Gilbert if you're one of the few people who's not yet familiar with her. I kind of fell very gently in love with her over the course of this hour. She's best known for Eat, Pray, Love, as I've mentioned. In this free extract from Luminary, we'll be talking about, well, I don't know which bit you're going to use. Jenny tends to use the beginning bit, I think, sort of primarily because of bone idleness of not. What bit are you going to use then? She doesn't even know. She doesn't even. Huh? This is going to. Right, well, let's try that. Let's try this bit where Elizabeth Gilbert talks about not going to war with your creativity, but learning to dance with it, and the sort of the myth of self-destruction. You know, we're all aware of people dying, whether it's Philip Seymour Hoffman or Amy Winehouse, Van Gogh, damn it. You know, people dying as a result of a kind of dance with their creativity. And we talked about the kind of machismo in that. I was the first person to say machismo in that context, and that's probably why I've remembered it, because I would have felt a little rush of cleverness. Anyway, you can have this for nothing, and if you like it, go subscribe to Luminary. There's some, you can get it for as little as $2.99 a month with that annual plan. Plus, you get a 7-day free trial. So visit luminarypodcast.com, start your free trial. Brené Brown's on there. Ricky Gervais is on there. Neil deGrasse Tyson. Mae Martin. I mean, there's some amazing podcasts. Not available in all markets, subject to local currency terms apply.
Trying to achieve equality with the annihilation of category is not a successful route.
Yes, that's exactly right.
We're in this era where it turns out we were never the boss.
It doesn't look like an ideology.
What's beneath the surface of people we admire, of the ideas that define our time, the history we are told?
And welcome to Russell Brand.
Under the Skin.
With the pagan animist perspective, seeing ideas and creativity as sort of having their own inherent consciousness, is that something that you have always intuited and understood, or is it something that you have slowly understood? And how does that affect the way you approach creativity and relationships?
This is my favorite thing to talk about, so I'm doing my body's starting to get jittery with excitement. But it's something that I always intuitively understood, didn't necessarily have language for, and then later discovered is how human beings have regarded creativity essentially forever until the Industrial Revolution, maybe until the Age of Enlightenment. We can go back maybe to the middle of the 18th century. But prior to that, And then ongoingly in any culture that has managed to avoid being corrupted by the Age of Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution, that's just how it is. It's how children get it. It's we understand it instinctively to be something that's coming to you from someplace else, and that you are not the commander of, but you are in a relationship with, and it's not, you're not the hand puppet of it. Because you bring your own will and your own consciousness to it. And then together, you and the mystery make a thing and you negotiate with each other. It has a will, you have a will. You know, when I'm writing a novel, especially because those worlds are so fantastical, the characters will pull at me to go in a certain direction, and then I'll negotiate with them and say, no, I'm insisting that this chapter remain this way. And then other times I'll give them the chapter. It's a conversation that I consider to be the most interesting possible way that you can spend your life, is to be in constant creative response and conversation with a mystery that I do not understand and don't know the source of, and will never know the source of, but I'm willing to spend my entire life engaged with it. So I did that sort of intuitively. And then what I saw as I went into the world, I saw everyone's tormented relationships with creativity, and I always puzzled at it. People seemed to be in a war with that thing rather than being in a dance with it. And not only that, the war had been fetishized by culture, so that your badge of honor as a serious artist is how destroyed you are by it. And the ultimate badge of honor, of course, is to become the ultimate human sacrifice to it and become one of the multitudes of creative suicides. I was like, why do you want to fight with something that doesn't want to fight with you? Why don't you just want to talk to it? Work with it, dance with it, engage with it, surrender to it sometimes. And I feel like it's really masculine. I feel like it's really modern. I feel like it's really Western. I feel like it's really male. It's this idea of like, we will have dominion over this thing, or one of us has to die, right? One of us has to die in this battle. And I'm not interested in that. I was never interested in it.
So you feel that creativity is continually wrangled into a kind of utility, and you see that as a kind of a post-enlightenment rational repurposing of the mystery. I was curious about Elizabeth, what you were saying about, you know, death and the struggle often being a mortal one, by the idea of sacrifice, human sacrifice, the necessity of sacrifice to access divinity. And do you see the presence of that idea in that struggle, or do you think that it's entirely the result of something beautiful that wants to be unfettered coming into collision with more recently acquired impulses and instincts, like you're saying, like, you know, trying to repurpose it, rather than, do you not think that in its origin creativity has a degree of destruction, like it blazes through the person?
Well, I think that the only really honest answer would be we can't know, because if we knew, then it wouldn't be the mystery. So the humble answer would be we can't know. The only way that I would be able to respond to that would be to say, how's that working for you? You know, how's it working for you to see it as a war? Are you good there? You know, do you want to stay in that war? Do you feel you have to stay in that war? Has anyone ever introduced you to some non-romantic, and I'm capitalizing romantic there, because that's a really romantic idea, like German romantic idea. Has anybody ever introduced you to a non-romantic idea that's based not in the romance of the blaze, but in the love of being a humble and amused and bemused servant and playmate with this thing? May I introduce some ideas? You know, that's really like what my book Big Magic was me sort of raising my hand and being like, and it took me years to do it because I wanted to feel that I had the authority to do it. I wanted to feel like I had enough years with this thing under my belt to be able to say, hey guys, and it is mostly guys, hey guys, there's another way, you know, there's another way where it doesn't have to be based in the fetishization of destruction and self-destruction, or in the war of dominance of you trying to kill this thing or this thing trying to kill you. There's another way. And if you're interested, here's what I've learned, you know, a modest proposal, maybe put down the knife, you know, maybe back away from the burning vehicle. And I know that a lot of people are really scared to put down the knife and back away from the burning vehicle because they associate creativity with that high of the drama and the rage and the fight and the battle and the torment. And they're afraid that if that goes, then they'll just become like a suburban vanilla person who can't make anything. And I don't believe that that's true. I think you may actually have a flowering of more creativity than you've ever had.
Have you in your own relationship with creativity experienced that destructiveness? And how, and if yes or even if no, how does that relate to addiction, which has, I understand and accept, as a kind of deviation from a kind of creative impulse towards oneness, towards service, towards love, you know, deviated primarily towards ego and self-centeredness. The reason I ask, Elizabeth, is because of reading some of your writing on being like a seduction addict and love addiction. And do you think there's a correlative between warped creativity and warped relationship becoming destructive and self-consuming, harmful?
Yeah, I do. And I think that it's about an unfettered, unloved ego needing to consume, swallow, control, and command everything in order to feel safe, in order to feel alive, in order to feel, in order to feel anything, that it's all got to be amped up and ramped up and revved up. And for some reason, Russell, I don't know why. I can only say it's grace, because I didn't do anything for it. And that's the definition of grace, is that you're given something that you didn't deserve. You're given something that you didn't fight for. You're just given it. I was given, it's almost like the universe or whatever, the mothership. I was given one area of my life where I was shown what a healthy relationship looks like. And that was in my relationship to my writing. And that was shown to me from a very early age. This is sanctuary here. This is the place where the war doesn't happen. And every once in a while, and then the rest of my relationships were just a shit tornado, because I had the God-sized hole that I was trying to fill there. And I've often said, God, I wish I could just relate with humans, and I'm learning how to relate with humans with as much detached, gentle, loving amusement as I relate with the muse, where it doesn't have to be such a war. And it can just be like, isn't it interesting that we're here? Like, that's the thing. Like, isn't it curious that this is happening? What do you think we can do here? Like, this gentle kind of playful curiosity instead of like this battlefield. And every once in a while, my ego has, when I see my ego come into my work, it's not there as much anymore, but it still shows up sometimes. But I'll give you an example of when I was younger and I didn't quite yet know how to do this dance with the work. I remember working on my first novel and it wasn't good. And why would it be? I'd never done one before. Like, why would you think you should be able to come out of the gate and know how to do something that you've never done before? And I was probably 75 pages into it. And I was in that place of terrible gap that people get into in creativity, where I had, Ira Glass has spoken about this beautifully, where I knew what good was, but I couldn't do it. So I'd been a consumer of writing for so long that I knew the difference between good writing and bad writing, but I couldn't create really good writing yet. I almost could, but I couldn't quite. And so that frustration of that canyon between what you know is good and what you can do, and that's what the struggle of the young artist is I'm not, my abilities have not yet caught up to my taste, you know, and my sorrow and my disappointment at the fact that I can't create what I see in my mind is like a toddler having a tantrum. It's really frustrating. And I remember being really devastated. My ego, it's a real ego blow, you know, my ego being really hurt and wounded by that. And I wanted to quit, and I was in tears. I mean, I had tears on pages of all my first books. I remember actually standing up in the room where I was working and just, And it was just this pushback against ego. It was this physical thing I had to do where I just stood up and I said to the universe, I never promised you I would be a good writer. I just said I would be a writer. Okay. So that's all I have for you. You know, and I never promised I would write good books. I just said I would write books. So this book is as good as I can make it. And I'm not going to, it's almost like a jujitsu flip where the ego turned to my own benefit, where I was able to use it in a good way to say, I'm not going to be somebody who goes to her grave with 75 pages of an unfinished novel in her desk drawer. So this book is going to be finished, and it's going to be finished at the level that I can do it. And that's all I have for you guys. And I always sort of refer to like creativity as you guys. It always feels like a mass to me of like very complex spirits. I'm like, you guys are getting what you're getting. You know? And if you want me to write better books, you might want to like bestow a little more talent on me for the next one, because this is literally as far as I can go. And that stubbornness to say that I would rather have it be done and lacking than to die on the cross of perfectionism is what made me be able to write my first few books. And now I don't even have to have that battle anymore, because now it's presumed that I'm just going to give you what I've got, and this is the best I have. And like I remember with my novel, The Signature of All Things, there was a character in there. I just couldn't get her right. She was the only person in the book who I felt like I didn't know. And I couldn't download her. I just couldn't. And I did what I could, but I always felt like she was a clumsy, awkward, kind of two-dimensional character. And then my hope was, as I wrote it, was that I would get away with it, because a lot of art is what you can get away with, right? So I was like, maybe no one will notice. Maybe it's just me. And hopefully when people read this book, like they won't see it. They won't see how I patched this thing together in a shoddy way. So I give it to everyone I know who are my first readers, and they all come back and say, we love the book, but this character doesn't work. I was like, ah, fuck, I didn't get away with it, right? Sometimes you do. And then I was like, I gave it to my editor, and he said the same thing. And it was such a lovely thing about the difference of being a mature age artist versus a younger artist, is that I was able to say, you know what, you guys, I actually can't fix this because I don't have the skill. You know, if I could do this better, I would have, but this is exactly as much as I can do with this character. And no one's going to die from a book that has a two-dimensional character in it. And also there's other stuff I want to do now. So this is the book, you know, this is the book. And then when it came out, the reviews often mentioned this character as being lacking. And the beautiful thing about just owning that is that I could read the reviews and be like, it's so cute that you guys think I don't know this. If I could do this better, I would, but this is all I have. And that's the humility of knowing your limit, which is the opposite of that thunderous, that massive ego that's like, I won't put out anything to the world unless it's, you know, it's Scorsese the night before he released Raging Bull saying, like, you know, if you don't, he literally said, I will commit suicide if you don't give me one more day to edit. You know, like, I'm not going to ever commit suicide because I failed on a character. I'm interested in doing the next thing because I like the process of it so much that I'm curious about, like, okay, well, that's what, you know, that's what I've got there. Now what? And I wish I had that level of detachment with everything in life, because then imagine just how playfully you could engage with all things, to be like, well, yep, there's a fail.
I'd never identified the machismo in that attitude before. I'd always taken it as standards, but of course standards must be derived from an ideal. And I see from what you're saying that there'll be a tremendous relief in approaching creativity from a place of acceptance and not feel the need to posture and not feel like my face flash if I read a negative review, to be free enough to sort of think, I don't care. Like, that was what came. I really like that.
That's as good as, if I could write a better book, I would. That's what I always want to say to the critics. Like, you and I are in agreement. You and I are in agreement. This isn't as good as maybe Hilary Mantel could do it, but you know, it's as good as Liz Gilbert can do it in the year 2016. Now, maybe 10 years from now, I can do better. But the only way that's going to happen is if I start a new thing. you know? So I'm going to have to let this one go and then go, you know, work my craft in another way.
I also like that you were saying that they're objectively... It was a two-dimensional character that you and every other single person that encountered that character thought, no. If you enjoyed that conversation, please join me over at Luminary for all of the latest episodes of Under the Skin, plus Karamo's brilliant podcast, Him Off Queer Eye. I've done that the other day. That'll be on there. Lena Dunham's on there. She's fantastic. Rain Wilson and Reza Aslan's podcast, Metaphysical Milkshake. We might be called that. I mean, they're obviously mucking around anyway, calling something Metaphysical Milkshake. They can't expect to be taken seriously, can they? Can any of us? Is there a point in that? Is that what we want? To be taken seriously. That's what I'm after. Yeah, go to luminarypodcast.com, get a whole bunch of podcasts for as little as $2.99 a month if you sign up for an annual plan, and there is a free trial, as I keep telling you. Thank you.